Chapter 9. Windows. A bar of light brought out the whiteness of a clump of lilies in the Hawes yard. And farther down the street, Carrick Fry's roaster lamp cast its bold illumination on the rustic flower tub in the middle of his grass plot. For a long time she continued to lean in the window, but a fever of unrest consumed her, and finally she went downstairs, took her hat from its hook, and swung out of the house. Mr. Royle sat in the porch, Verena beside him, her old hands crossed on her patched skirt. As Charity went down the steps, Mr. Royle called after her. "Here you going?" She could easily have answered, "Oh, Ormus," or "On to the targets." And either answer might have been true, for as he had no purpose. But she swept on in silence, determined not to recognize his right to question her. At the gate she paused and looked up and down the road. The darkness drew her, and she thought of climbing the hill and plunging into the depths of the larch wood above the pasture. Then she glanced irresolutely along the street, and as she did, so a gleam appeared through the spruces at Miss Hatchard's gate. Lucius Harney was there, then he had not gone down to Hepburn with Mr. Miles, as he had at first imagined. But where had he taken his evening meal, and what had caused him to stay away from Mr. Royle's? The light was positive proof of his presence, for Miss Hatchard's servants were away on the holiday, and her farmer's wife came only in the mornings, to make the young man's bed, and prepare his coffee. Beside that lamp he was doubtless sitting at this moment. To know the truth, Charity had only to walk half the length of the village, and knock at the lighted window. She hesitated a minute or two longer, and then turned toward Miss Hatchard's. She walked quickly, straining her eyes to detect anyone who might be coming along the street, and before reaching the Fry's she crossed over to avoid the light from their window. Whenever she was unhappy, she felt herself at bay against a pitiless world, and a kind of animal secretiveness possessed her. But the street was empty, and she passed unnoticed through the gate, and up the path to the house. Its white front glimmered indistinctly through the trees, showing only one oblong of light on the lower floor. As he had supposed, that the lamp was in Miss Hatchard's sitting room, but she now saw that it shone through a window at the farther corner of the house. She did not know the room to which this window belonged, and she paused under the trees, checked by a sense of strangeness. Then she moved on, treading softly on the short grass, and keeping so close to the house, that whoever was in the room, even if roused by her approach, would not be able to see her. The window opened on a narrow veranda with a trellised arch. She leaned close to the trellis, and parting the sprays of clematis that covered it, looked into a corner of the room. She saw the foot of a mahogany bed, an engraving on the wall, a washstand on which a towel had been tossed, and one end of the green-covered table which held the lamp. Half of the lampshade projected into her field of vision, and just under it two smooth sunburnt hands, one holding a pencil and the other a ruler, were moving to and fro over a drawing board. Her heart jumped, and then stood still. He was there, a few feet away. And while her soul was tossing on seas of woe, he had been quietly sitting at his drawing board. The sight of those two hands, moving with their usual skill and precision, woke her out of her dream. Her eyes were open to the disproportion between what he had felt and the cause of her agitation, and she was turning away from the window when one hand abruptly pushed aside the drawing board and the other flung down the pencil. Charity had often noticed Harney's loving care of his drawings, and the neatness and method with which he carried on and concluded each task. The impatient sweeping aside of the drawing board seemed to reveal a new mood. The gesture suggested sudden discouragement or distaste for his work, and she wondered if he too were agitated by secret perplexities. Her impulse of flight was checked. She stepped upon the veranda and looked into the room. Harney had put his elbows on the table, and was resting his chin on his locked hands. He had taken off his coat and waistcoat, and unbuttoned the low collar of his flannel shirt. She saw the vigorous lines of his young throat, and the root of the muscles, where they joined the chest. He sat staring straight ahead of him, a look of weariness and self-disgust on his face. It was almost as if he had been gazing at a distorted reflection of his own features. For a moment Charity looked at him with a kind of terror, as if he had been a stranger under familiar lineaments. Then she glanced past him and saw on the floor an open portmanteau half full of clothes. She understood that he was preparing to leave, and that he had probably decided to go without seeing her. She saw that the decision, from whatever cause it was taken, had disturbed him deeply, and she immediately concluded that his change of plan was due to some surreptitious interference of Mr. Royle's. All her old resentments and rebellions flamed up, confusedly mingled with the yearning roused by Harney's nearness. Only a few hours earlier as he had felt secure in his comprehending pity, now she was flung back on herself, doubly alone after that moment of communion. Harney was still unaware of her presence. He sat without moving, moodily staring before him at the same spot in the wallpaper. He had not even had the energy to finish his packing, and his clothes and papers lay on the floor about the portmanteau. Presently he unlocked his clasped hands and stood up, and Charity, drawing back hastily, sank down on the step of the veranda. The night was so dark that there was not much chance of his seeing her unless he opened the window, and before that she would have time to slip away and be lost in the shadow of the trees. He stood for a minute or two looking around the room with the same expression of self-disgust, as if he hated himself and everything about him. Then he sat down again at the table, drew a few more strokes, and threw his pencil aside. Finally he walked across the floor, kicking the portmanteau out of his way, and lay down on the bed, folding his arms under his head, and staring up morosely at the ceiling. Just so, Charity had seen him at her side on the grass or the pine needles, his eyes fixed on the sky, and pleasure flashing over his face like the flickers of sun the branches shed on it. But now the face was so changed that she hardly knew it, and grief at his grief gathered in her throat, rose to her eyes and ran over. She continued to crouch on the steps, holding her breath and stiffening herself into complete immobility. One motion of her hand, one tap on the pane, and she could picture the sudden change in his face. In every pulse of her rigid body she was aware of the welcome his eyes and lips would give her. But something kept her from moving. It was not the fear of any sanction, human or heavenly, as he had never in her life been afraid. It was simply that as he had suddenly understood what would happen if she went in. It was the thing that did happen between young men and girls, and that North Dormer ignored in public and snickered over on the sly. It was what Miss Hatchard was still ignorant of, but every girl of Charity's class knew about before she left school. It was what had happened to Eliha's sister Julia, and had ended in her going to Nettleton, and in people's never mentioning her name. It did not, of course, always end so sensationally, nor, perhaps, on the whole, so untragically. Charity had always suspected that the shunned Julia's fate might have its compensations. There were others, worse endings that the village knew of, mean, miserable, unconfessed, other lives that went on drearily, without visible change, in the same cramped setting of hypocrisy. But these were not the reasons that held her back. Since the day before, as he had known exactly what she would feel if Harney should take her in his arms. The melting of palm into palm and mouth on mouth, and the long flame burning her from head to foot. But mixed with this feeling was another. The wondering pride in his liking for her, the startled softness that his sympathy had put into her heart. Sometimes, when her youth flushed up in her, as he had imagined yielding like other girls to furtive caresses in the twilight, but she could not so cheapen herself to Harney. She did not know why he was going. But since he was going she felt she must do nothing to deface the image of her that he carried away. If he wanted her, he must seek her. He must not be surprised into taking her as girls like Julia Hawes were taken. No sound came from the sleeping village, and in the deep darkness of the garden she heard now and then a secret rustle of branches, as though some night bird brushed them. Once a footfall passed the gate, and she shrank back into her corner, but the steps died away and left a profounder quiet. Her eyes were still on Arnie's tormented face. She felt she could not move till he moved. But she was beginning to grow numb from her constrained position, and at times her thoughts were so indistinct that she seemed to be held there only by a vague weight of weariness. A long time passed in this strange vigil. Arnie still lay on the bed, motionless and with fixed eyes, as though following his vision to its bitter end. At last he stirred and changed his attitude slightly, and Charity's heart began to tremble. But he only flung out his arms and sank back into his former position. With a deep sigh, he tossed the hair from his forehead. Then his whole body relaxed, his head turned sideways on the pillow, and she saw that he had fallen asleep. The sweet expression came back to his lips, and the haggardness faded from his face, leaving it as fresh as a boy's. She rose and crept away. She had lost the sense of time, and did not know how late it was till she came out into the street and saw that all the windows were dark between Miss Hatchard's and the royal house. As she passed from under the black pall of the Norway spruces, she fancied she saw two figures in the shade about the duck pond. She drew back and watched, but nothing moved, and as he had stared so long into the lamp-lit room, that the darkness confused her, and she thought she must have been mistaken. She walked on, wondering whether Mr. Royal was still in the porch. In her exalted mood, she did not greatly care whether he was waiting for her or not. She seemed to be floating high over life, on a great cloud of misery beneath which everyday realities had dwindled to mere specks in space. But the porch was empty, Mr. Royal's hat hung on its peg in the passage, and the kitchen lamp had been left to light her to bed. She took it and went up. The morning hours of the next day dragged by without incident. Charity had imagined that, in some way or other, she would learn whether Arnie had already left, but Verena's deafness prevented her being a source of news, and no one came to the house who could bring enlightenment. Mr. Royal went out early, and did not return till Verena had set the table for the midday meal. When he came in, he went straight to the kitchen, and shouted to the old woman, "Edie for dinner." Then he turned into the dining room, where Charity was already seated. Arnie's plate was in its usual place, but Mr. Royal offered no explanation of his absence, and Charity asked none. The feverish exultation of the night before had dropped, and she said to herself that he had gone away, indifferently, almost callously, and that now her life would lapse again into the narrow rut out of which he had lifted it. For a moment she was inclined to sneer at herself for not having used the arts that might have kept him. She sat at table till the meal was over, lest Mr. Royal should remark on her leaving. But when he stood up, she rose also, without waiting to help Verena. As he had her foot on the stairs, when he called to her to come back. "I've got a headache. I'm going up to lie down. I want you should come in here first. I've got something to say to you." She was sure from his tone that in a moment she would learn what every nerve in her ached to know. But as she turned back, she made a last effort of indifference. Mr. Royal stood in the middle of the office, his thick eyebrows beetling, his lower jaw trembling a little. At first she thought he had been drinking, then she saw that he was sober, but stirred by a deep and stern emotion totally unlike his usual transient angers. And suddenly she understood that, until then, as he had never really noticed him or thought about him. Except on the occasion of his one offense, he had been to her merely the person who is always there, the unquestioned central fact of life, as inevitable but as uninteresting as North Dormer itself, or any of the other conditions fate had laid on her. Even then she had regarded him only in relation to herself, and had never speculated as to his own feelings, beyond instinctively concluding that he would not trouble her again in the same way. But now she began to wonder what he was really like. He had grasped the back of his chair with both hands, and stood looking hard at her. At length he said, "Charity, for once lets you and me talk together like friends." Instantly she felt that something had happened, and that he held her in his hand. "Where is Mr. Arnie? Why hasn't he come back? Have you?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.